from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. December 28, 1986. By most measures, not an especially notable day. Sundays are sleepy that way, especially one tucked between the holiday bookends of Christmas and New Year. Stories on the front pages of major papers were mostly same old, same old. The author Gene Weingarten of The Washington Post literally pulled the day and year out of a hat, with some help, and then embarked on a years-long journey to find episodes occurring that day that helped define people's lives in ways modest and overwhelming, a day marked by grief, by discovery, humor, and good luck, forming together a rich tapestry of life and how it's really lived. He's captured them in a new book, this hour On Point, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary Day, 33 years ago. Join us to talk about this singular project, a labor of love chronicling stories of everyday life that are turning points, reminders, and rebukes. What questions do you have for the author and journalist, Gene Weingarten? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us, as I mentioned, from Washington, D.C. at NPR's headquarters, Gene Weingarten. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The Washington Post, where he writes Below the Beltway, a weekly humor column. His latest book is One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. It is a book born of a conceit and a dare. We'll learn all about it now. Gene Weingarten, welcome to On Point.
Good to be here.
And I'm happy to tell listeners you can find an excerpt of One Day at our website, onpointradio.org. Gene Weingarten, before we talk about the project, set the scene. Take us back, late December, December 28th, 1986. What is life like in America that day?
Well, it is, in fact, a very ordinary day. You know, we, as you said very well, it was a sleepy Sunday in the sleepiest week of the year. Ronald Reagan was president. Walk Like an Egyptian was the big song on the radio. The big book in America was Fatherhood. Fatherhood was, Bill Cosby's book. It became the biggest bestseller, the fastest bestseller in history because the guy was so beloved, you know?
Just good advice from a humanist, as we thought then.
Good advice from a great dad and father and man, yeah.
Our dissolution would come decades later. And, you know, it was a year of consequence. You had the Challenger shuttle explosion. You had the Iran-Contra affair explode into view in a different way. The scourge of AIDS really became more of a publicly acknowledged phenomenon. And these things touch through. These are threads in the larger fabric that you create before our eyes in this book. But you really drill down in ways, as you call it, microscopic and panoramic. So you know, let's acknowledge this is a stunt of the first order, right? this is a journalistic conceit. And there's no way of saying this is a literary – you're saying we want to figure out a way to tell stories. Darn it, I'm going to find a stunt to do it.
Yeah, I'm really a big fan of stunts, and I'm known for some of them. I'm the guy who put Joshua Bell outside a metro stop in Washington, incognito, playing his Stradivarius as though he were just some sort of beggar.
One of the world's most eminent violinists.
And possibly the most eminent violinist, yeah. And he was game to try that. So we did that for 1 hour one morning during rush hour. And it became a story that sort of had global reach because basically people were too busy. They just hurried past this stunningly beautiful thing as though it were a nuisance. So, yeah, this is a stunt. It turned into what I think was a literary achievement, but it definitely started out as just a swagger by a journalist.
So look, what, you know, take, you know, 30 seconds to tell us what, how you actually came by that day and by that conceit, and then sketch out what were your aspirations for it? What did you want to achieve?
Yeah, this pretty much started out as an act of arrogance and stupidity.
That's so much journalism does.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, particularly my journalism. But basically, I found myself entering my mid-60s and feeling complacent I wanted to goose myself a little bit intellectually. And so I decided to try something that I honestly was not sure would work. I just wanted a jolt of adrenaline. So I decided that what I wanted to do was test a thesis that I'd always talked about, but never proved and never saw anyone else try to prove, possibly for good reason, which is that there's no such thing as an ordinary day. That, you know, if you took this basic irreducible unit of human experience, 24 hours, midnight to midnight, in theory, you would find embedded in it all the grand themes of human experience. You know, you'd have tragedy, you'd have comedy, you'd have grand comeuppances, you'd have great ironies, you'd have everything. That was the idea, and I had no true sense that it would work except a little bit of faith. We had children pull numbers out of a hat, as you said, and wound up with this date that seemed immediately problematic. I will say that my contract called for this book to be done in 2 years, and I wound up delivering the manuscript 6 years later.
It's an editor who knows how to bust deadlines.
Well, it's the first deadline I've busted in my life, but I made up for it by really busting it.
You sure did. I mean, look, so that listeners know, you know, so much of your work has been in public view, has been done as a writer. You were also an editor. You edited the humor columnist, the noted humor columnist Dave Barry down at the Miami Herald. You edited Tony Kornheiser at the Washington Post, and I am told reliably improved both along the way. And yet, this is, while there's some wit involved here, this is really thoughtful, moving, poignant stuff that you get into, that you spent so many years on. I wondered if we could pick, a couple of – over the course of this hour, we'll pick a couple of these vignettes and we'll speak to a couple of people who feature in your book. But maybe we could talk about this is a tough story, but Michael Anthony Green for a few minutes. And this is one of those stories that, as happens a number of times, you think it's about one person. It's about more than one person, right? You're thinking about a firefighter in Dallas and the young boy whom he encounters. Tell me about how these two lives came together on December 28th and how they emerged in surprising ways.
Yeah, 3 a.m., a call goes out that there's a fire in I got the time wrong. It's not 3 a.m. It was later in the morning. A fire broke out in the suburb of Dallas, Texas, and that there were children involved. The firefighters come on the scene as fast as they can. It's clear that this is a very bad fire and that kids are trapped in there. A firefighter named Richard Lane, very gutsy man, decided he didn't even have time to wrestle on an oxygen mask. And so he ran into the building trying to catch his air, his oxygen, from the nozzle of the hose he had. And that's something that all firefighters know you can do. Very few will actually try it. There's a little ring of oxygen that comes out as the water is coming out. And the air in there was toxic, but he was able to breathe that way. He found two children. One was dead. One was barely alive. Very young, not yet 2 years old. He passed the kid out through a window he broke to paramedics. They rushed him to the hospital, Parkland Hospital, the same one that John F. Kennedy died in. He assumed the child would die. He really didn't think about it much after that, because you don't. You have to get on to the next horror. But the child lived. And he is now in his early 30s. He is horribly disfigured. He talks about himself. He has talked about himself as a monster. He's not a monster. He is a horribly disfigured, rather brilliant young man who has made astonishing strides in his life, despite having, for example, no hands and a melted face. His name is Michael Anthony Green.
And you talk about how in sitting with him, you ultimately move past sort of thinking about that to thinking about his life. You know, that you didn't think that you would get past that recognition of his disfigurement, his disability, his enduring injuries. And yet you do. And you shed that thought to think about what he's doing. He talks about his dating life. He talks about, I think, video games. He talks about other things and working. And you think about the life that he has built. And interestingly, then you also connect it, and we only have a brief amount of time, but you connect it with the firefighter's life, which went off the rails, and yet he rediscovers himself with, if I'm not mistaken, the nurse who helped to tend to the young boy and help nurse him back to life.
They're married now. They weren't at the time. In fact, that's how he learned. She was a friend of his, a platonic friend, and that's how he learned that Michael had lived. He was talking to her. She worked in the burn unit at the time. And she said, boy, we got this horrible case in, we're barely keeping him alive. And all Richard could think of was, wait, he's alive?
In a sense, she nurses him, makes sure that he's thought of as a person throughout his care. And yet when she reconnects with the firefighter, the two of them find a life together, and it sustains the firefighter in an unexpected way as well. We're discussing the challenges and fulfillment of uncovering the extraordinary and defining moments in seeding everyday lives. You can join our conversation. If you were asked to pick an incident, what would you choose from that day? What deviations do you find meaning and inspiration in? You're hearing Walk Like an Egyptian, a number one song that week, talking about December 28th, 1986, with Gene Weingarten. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
The pond waitresses take their trays, spin around, and they cross the floor. They've got the moves. Oh, you drop your drink, then they bring you more. All the school kids so sick of books. They like the punk and the metal band. When the buzzer rings, oh, they're walking like an Egyptian. All the kids in the marketplace say,
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking back at a chronicle of the day of December 28th, 1986, a seemingly random tapestry of interwoven vignettes replete with ardor, depression, epiphanies, dumb luck, heartbreak, and so much more. You can join our conversations. What questions do you have for my guest, the journalist Gene Weingarten? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, Gene Weingarten. He's author of the new book, One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. You know, you have a couple of moments that veer between wry observations and poetry here, Gene. On page 156, you write, life is essentially a fatal disease of indeterminate duration. You can either cry at the unfairness of this or laugh at its absurdity. What do you do?
In this book?
Well, in your life,
I do both. That's a very canny question. I basically do two things. I write very sad long stories, and I write funny short stories. And you've touched on something interesting, because I do think that humor and tragedy are made of the same stuff. It's like energy and matter. It's different sides of the same thing, and you can either, life is terrifying, and you can either laugh at it or you can cry at it. By doing both, I kind of relieve myself from some pressure there. The humor that I write kind of underwrites the serious stuff. If I only wrote stories about people who died or nearly died in fires or were victimized by murders or whatever, I'd walk around like a melancholic, like Raskolnikov. So one helps the other.
And
it keeps me sane. Doing both keeps me sane.
And thankfully, to our knowledge, you are not a homicidal Russian, so that's a big plus for us. Let's talk a little bit about an event that occurred, I guess, at 4:25 p.m., Matlock, Washington. Daylight slipping away, a helicopter goes down. Let's talk about the story of Brad Wilson. It takes a couple of turns that are just so surprising. Tell me a little bit about this guy.
He's a successful businessman. He loved flying little helicopters. He loved doing two things. He loved flying helicopters and fishing. And on this day, he set out in the morning with a friend in his tiny helicopter. Basically, it could hold two men, their gear, and as many fish as they could bring home, and that's about it. They flew off into the place they like to fish, which is a place only a helicopter can get to. No wheeled vehicle could get to that part of those streams. So they're basically unfished. And they spent the day fishing. They were cold. They were exhausted. They were happy. They had a whole bunch of fish. Steelhead trout, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And they headed back home. It got rainy. It got cold. Visibility got very poor. So he decided that he had to do something seat of the pants. When you have a little helicopter, you have to deal with things in sometimes primitive ways. And so he landed in the middle of a lumber yard, took off both of the door. He took off the driver's side door and gave it to his passenger to hold in his lap. And that allowed him to navigate not through the foggy windshield, but straight out into the air. You know, his visibility became better, and he was going to basically navigate sideways like a crab. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, something really bizarre happened. When he was down on the ground, a long strap of metal got entangled in one of his struts. And he took off, got about 20 feet in the air, pitched the helicopter forward to start on his trip, and got yanked back to the ground. In fact, he got inverted so that the helicopter literally turned upside down and the rotors were augering him down into the ground from a height of 20 feet. And the thing that he remembers thinking, he couldn't say anything. There was no time. This all happened in about a second and a half. But the thing he remembers thinking was, nobody ever survives this.
But
so that's how this adventure began.
Uh-huh.
He wound up slamming into the ground. It was a bed of tree bark, so it was fairly soft. Neither he nor his passenger was particularly injured. The helicopter was destroyed. They let themselves out of the wreck and started running in case it would explode. That all happened on that day. And then really weirder stuff happened as a follow-up. The first thing was he got on the phone with his wife.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and essentially she informed him, without directly informing him, that their marriage was done.
No, I like the version you tell in the book better. You say in the book that she said to him, you got yourself into this problem, you can get yourself out of it.
That's quite what I mean. She told him, in effect, that their marriage was done.
Yeah.
And he understood that at that moment. A lot of things happened in the life of Brad Wilson afterwards. One of them was that he did indeed get a divorce. He got custody of the children. And his wife disappeared with the children, just took them and ran, lived under an assumed name for very many years.
Mm-hmm.
He finally got them back, and his youngest son didn't know who he was.
Mm.
So that was interesting. And then came the question of how Brad Wilson would sort of repay the world for being saved. He actually was saved a second time that day. His car almost crashed in the trip back to the helicopter. His life essentially was spared twice within a 24-hour period. And he's not a particularly introspective man. He's not a particularly religious man. He doesn't really believe in karma. But it kind of worked out that Karma believed in him. Mm-hmm. Because in the next few years, this single helicopter pilot saved four lives, rescued four lives in his helicopter. None of those were things that he planned to go and do. He just stumbled into it. And, you know, I asked him at the end, do you think that this was like the thumbprint of God? He said, nah, I'm just out there in the wild a lot. It'll happen. I'll save people.
Well, lucky that he was able to do so. Lucky for them in particular. But an incredible story with almost as many turns as the rotors of that doomed helicopter. I want to
And the odd thing is, the odd thing is, as with a lot of these stories, it wasn't handed to me. All that I had to begin with was the FAA report for the day. I wanted to see were there any interesting crashes, and it just mentioned his in a paragraph. Mm-hmm. And the rest developed after talking to sources and finding him, etc. It was very much that way with a lot of these stories.
I want to turn to someone who's featured in your book. Heather Armstrong is founder of the popular blog Deuce, which she created in 2001, chronicling her experiences with motherhood. She joined us now from Salt Lake City, Utah. Heather, thanks for joining us on this. Can you tell us what life was like on the 28th of December, 1986? How do you remember?
Well, first of all, it's good to be with you. And how do I remember? I am a visual learner, and I remember writing the date specifically. And December 28th, 1986, I saved the princess today. I was forbidden to play Nintendo, and I had spent the entire morning sort of stealthily playing at my friend's house, and I saved the princess for the first time in Super Mario Brothers.
I saved the princess.
I saved the princess, yes.
And so you scribble that on a piece of paper. What do you do with it?
I put it. I was a terrible pack rat as a child, and then being paid for it with my own children. I used to save wrappers, like gum wrappers and tinfoil, and I had this box of like scraps of things that I would save, and I threw it into that box because no one was around to see me do it. And I don't even think my friend believed that I had done it, and I didn't even know I could replicate it. But just knowing, just having written it down for me was significant because I could hold on to it and I could hide it from my mom.
Mm-hmm. And Heather, you know, you end up writing about motherhood, but this story about what happened 33 years ago is wrapped in a larger story of your relationship with your mother, your family, your faith. What's going on at that time? Why are you prevented from playing video games? And what's happening in your heart and your household at that time?
I grew up in a very religious, a very Mormon family, and we had an Atari, but like Gene says in the book, the graphics at the time on Nintendo's were more lifelike, and screen time then even was like, oh, our kids are playing video games, and that's responsible for all of the drugs and murder, and like even Super Mario Brothers was getting blamed for bad behavior, and They wanted to raise good children, and I think they did, but they were worried about the influence of video games in general. And so I would sneak to my friend's house to watch MTV, which we were not allowed to watch. And, like, that's where I saw all the music videos. That's where I discovered Prince. And so playing Super Mario Brothers without my mother knowing, and I was a very, very good child, was very, very risky for me in terms of my own integrity, but I really wanted to do it.
Gene Weingarten, how did you – we're keeping Heather Armstrong on with us. She's the founder of the popular blog Deuce. How did you come across Heather Armstrong, and how did you – more important, how did you come across – not that she might be an interesting person to write about, and she certainly has a significant social media following these days, but that she has a connection to the day of the 28th of December, 1986?
Well, that was easy. The harder part was figuring out why this was important. I connected with her because she's a blogger, and she mm-hmm. actually blogged about that day. And that's how I found it. I found it in her blog. What I found fascinating was that here is a little girl who, on that day, did something seditious for maybe the first time in her life. Mm-hmm. And her life after that, and by the way, hello, Heather. It's good to talk to you. I do want to say that I've gotten a lot of comments from readers that they were really glad that you were in the book, not only because your story was interesting, but because they knew you were a celebrity. And there are not that many celebrities in my book, a lot, you know, other than what happened to them on that day. They were people most people didn't know about. You were an actual celeb, and it to many people that sort of anchored the book. So thank you for that.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, the thing that fascinated me about Heather's little story, and of course it is a little story, is that she did something seditious for the first time in her life. And Heather, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically the rest of her life was about doing seditious things.
Yes. Do you think that's fair, Heather? You a little subversive in terms of at least how your family had looked at things?
Yeah, I mean, again, I was a really good kid, but I always, you know, I inherited my father's irreverent sense of humor. Of course, I've taken it to a new level, but I'm the only member of my family. And mind you, I was the best kid by far in terms of behavior and grades and graduating valedictorian and getting a full scholarship to BYU. But I, you know, my fate unraveled and I explored many, 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 many things that my family have never come close to touching. And
I just need to. I have to interrupt here just by saying that you're being bashful, Heather, because there is a term, a well-known term, called being deuced, and that term refers to somebody who gets fired from their job for what they blog. And that in fact happened to Heather very early. She became one of the real internet stars, and that's about being subversive.
Yes.
And it's also.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Heather.
I was trying to be subversive. I was enjoying it, thinking that no one important was reading it, but then sort of realizing quite a few important people were reading it, including my family.
And so your bosses.
Yes, and my office, which fired me, yes.
Relatively quickly, it seems like. Kind of whipped around one day, it seemed like a source of amusement. Within about 48 hours, not so much.
Right.
And it sounds as though, you know, in what Jean writes, that you ultimately effected a reconciliation with your mother and found ways to bond with your own daughter, who was doing her own kind of resistance, through what? Through this very same vehicle.
Yes. As a kid, again, I was never a rebellious child. And it's not that my child is rebellious, but she does put up a lot more fight than I ever did. And we have butted heads, you know, throughout her childhood. And I sat next to her on the couch for a couple of hours playing this game with her. And it was not that we hadn't ever bonded before.
The video game.
And she was
the same video game.
The same video game.
Exactly. And, I mean, I'm sure that my mother could probably point to me saving the princess and saying, see all those awful things you did in your life? You got fired because of Super Mario Brothers. But, you know, she's come to love my children and she's come to recognize herself in me. I mean, I'm sure she would probably want to take credit for having saved the princess. Like, I'm the one who taught her, you know, the skill to stick with it. But it's a sort of a full circle, you know, that is sort of one of the big points of the full circle between me and my mom and my daughter is this video game about with toads and princesses and whatnot.
But, I mean, you sat down and you kind of rocked it. I mean, it sounded as though you had sort of conjured a magic trick for your daughter who said, oh, my gosh, my mom has these hidden depths I had no idea about. And in your mind, you were the girl who saved the princess.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And for the first time, I think she saw me as not necessarily cool, but it was like I was more than just a mom. She was like, oh, she actually has depth.
Well, you're hearing there from Heather Armstrong. She's best-selling author and founder of the website Deuce. She's featured in Gene Weingarten's book, One Day. Heather Armstrong, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
We are looking back this hour on a randomly selected day, December 28, 1986, and the extraordinary stories my guest has uncovered in everyday life. You can join the conversation. What questions or contributions do you have for my guest? We are going to hear the strains of the song Everybody Have Fun Tonight by, of course, Wang Chung. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Everybody have fun tonight. Everybody.
did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. The author Gene Weingarten whisks us back to December 28, 1986, with his new book, One Day, unearthing intimate stories of daily life that, taken together, help define America. It is a stunt and also a staggering literary feat, profiling heart doctors and drug users, profiling political operatives and pastors. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for my guest? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, as I say, Gene Weingarten, author of the new book, One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. I want to take a few of your calls. We have a call from Ellsworth, Maine. Matthias, thanks for listening to the show. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, David and Gene. It's great to be here. I'm excited very much so to read this book. I couldn't help but overhear on the radio today as I was driving around the date that came out, and it's a very important date in my life. That is the date that I was conceived.
That you were conceived?
Conceived. Yeah, I'm 32 years old, and, you know, as you do when you get older, in your late 20s, you sort of ask those questions of your parents that you've always kind of wanted to know, and I wanted to know exactly when I was conceived and where, and the 28th is the date. So
I'm not sure I could tell you exactly the date my two kids were conceived. So
I'm not sure that's something that shows up on Google or Bing, but that's some intrepid reporting there, Matthias. Well, thank you for listening. I trust you're going to buy the book and figure out the other stories. But I hope that was a question your parents felt comfortable fielding. Juan has been listening as well. Juan's calling from Brunswick, Georgia. Thank you for calling in, Juan. Tell us about your 1986. Tell us about your day.
First of all, I want to thank you guys. You're about the only radio station I've listened to because you have an independent feeling. Anyway,
thank you, sir.
In that year, 1986, I was in the Army Reserves under President Reagan. He was Commander-in-Chief. But I think the night before, I had a real good friend of mine show up to my house, and he contracted the AIDS virus, okay? Mm-hmm. And I decided to keep him in my home. I put him down in a basement. I'm originally from South Philadelphia, but news got out that he was in my home, and some of my neighbors were very distraught, you know, really angry at me. And I kept him for about 2-3 days, and I tried to get over his family, and the family didn't want anything to do with him. I just can remember that he was so adamant that he was not a homosexual that somehow he was anemic and he got contaminated or something like that. But mm-hmm. I felt so, you know, so I felt so helpless. You know, there was no one to call. You know, I mean, there was nobody to turn to. So he got a little bit healthier. He was constantly going to the bathroom. You know, we didn't have any idea what this thing was for real. And I just can remember having him in my home and ready to defend him, you know, if anybody tried to hurt him. But it was really, you know, it was a sad day. But at the same time, you know, I understood that, you know, we got to protect each other, you know. Mm-hmm. And
Juan, I mean, you're showing and, you know, in ways that Gene brings to life as well, but that life as it's lived, there's a moment of compassion at a time of helplessness and of uncertainty and it's in some ways hostility even from your own neighbors, making sure that somebody felt wrapped in it. Go ahead, Gene Weingarten.
This was a time of this was a time of terrible misunderstanding about AIDS and what it was, and the public was just terrified. And, you know, the better nature, the better angels of our nature were not coming out. 1986 was the year that there were three little boys in Arcadia, Florida, who had, they were hemophiliacs, and they had contracted AIDS from blood transfusions. You know, their parents had to fight to get the school to let them stay in their public school. And eventually, after just a few days, the parents had to flee the city because arsonists had burned their house down.
I was going to say, and Gene, and indeed you write, in fact, about two men with very different stories who died of AIDS that year. Terry Dolan, the firebrand conservative political activist who had a secret not only of being gay but of being AIDS positive and HIV positive, ultimately died of AIDS denying that. And Joel Reznikoff, liberal figure who also died of AIDS but sort of owned his identity and who he
owned his identity. He died at peace with himself. Terry Dolan did not.
Thank you so much, Juan, for that call and for sharing that. It is the kind of story that Gene Weingarten brings to light. I wanted to briefly play one clip. One of the big public events of 1986 was the Iran-Contra scandal, which engulfed the final years of Ronald Reagan's second term in the White House. As people may recall, the affair involved the sale of arms to Iran, then a foe, in exchange for the release of U.S. prisoners. That activity began in 1985, flared open in the following year. Here's President Reagan finally addressing the nation on March 4th, 1987, and acknowledging his own failings of the previous months.
A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not.
Now, we, of course, in this hour, are focused not on March 1987, but on a specific day in December 1986. And on that date, December 28th, President Reagan noted in his journal that he had met separately with his children, Ron Jr. and Maureen, and their spouses. And President Reagan wrote, "Subject again, Iran, and why I don't display anger, etc. Fire someone. I think I'm doing it right." How important were journal entries and personal reminiscences that had been recorded contemporaneously to your getting people to remember the moments of the lives they lived?
What's interesting to me is that there are different kind of diaries. And Ronald Reagan's was the diary of somebody in the public eye, in the public gyre, who was basically trying to speak to history. And as you can imagine, that's not the kind of diary that is the most honest. One of the other chapters was about a diarist, a woman who wrote only for herself. And on that particular day, she spent quite a while analyzing why her marriage was just spectacularly breaking down. And, you know, you look at Ronald Reagan's terse diary entry, which is essentially defensive. And this woman's entry, which is just opening a vein and bleeding onto the page. And you realized there are diaries and there are diaries. And her diary made a chapter and his diary made a sentence in the book.
I want to now welcome to our conversation another person who figures importantly, and it's a fascinating story and journey in this book. Her name is Ellie Krug. She's an attorney, in some ways a legal rights advocate, as I understand it, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, from which she's joining us. And she's also author of Getting to Ellen, a memoir about love, honesty, and gender change. Ellie, tell us a little bit about December 28th of that year. Where were you and why did it turn out to be, if you believe it to be, a turning point, a memorable moment for you in your life?
Well, hello, David, and hi, Gene.
Hey, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Gene. December 28th, 1986 was my 30th birthday. And I remember the day very vividly because I was married at the time. I had married my high school sweetheart, Linda. We were living in Boston at the time, but we had both grown up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and we were back for the holidays to visit family. And my ex-wife, Linda, had lugged in her suitcase secretly the very first Sony Discman CD player when it first came out. I mean, this was like a 5-pound brick. And she had holed that in her suitcase secretly. And on December 28th, I woke up, and as was her practice, she could never wait to give me presents. So I'm like literally 5 minutes awake, laying in bed still, and she plops this box, wrapped box on my stomach, and it says, "Happy birthday." Now, that date was, I mean, obviously, that was the start of CD technology and all of that. But more importantly, it was important to me because I so love my wife. But I had a secret. I was fighting myself, and I had been doing that for a number of years, over my gender identity. And so, of course, your listeners right now are hearing the voice of a man. But my name is Ellie, and I transitioned genders. It took another 23 years after December 28th, 86, for me to transition. And in that time, I had to deal with the issue and the struggle of loving myself more than I loved her, and that by the time it was done, we had two daughters. And it took a very, very long time for me to get to that point of understanding that some things in life aren't choices, and one of those is your gender.
You were known as a killer Krug, if I'm not mistaken, for being sort of a fearsome lawyer. And then as you transition, you talk, at least as reflected in Gene's book, about how, you know, your legal career took a different turn. And we can talk about that in a moment. What was it like being called by Gene Weingarten to say, "I want to feature you, I want to talk about this, and I want to talk about that"? Such a personal day and such a personal pivot moment for your life.
Well, actually, I was the one that contacted Gene.
Gene Weingarten has people rappelling down buildings to tell him stories about this day. Go ahead, Ellie. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. I was visiting Connecticut at the time, and I just by chance, I had time to do a little bit of work, and I turned on WNEW, and Bob Edwards was interviewing this guy named Gene Weingarten, who I had no idea about, and Gene was talking about this idea he had for a book, and it was all around one day. And what Gene did, and you know you did this, Gene, is that you teased what that day was. I mean, we had to go for many minutes before, you know, Edwards finally just said, "Okay, what is the day?" And you said December 28, 1986. And as soon as you said that, you also said, "If you know something about this day, reach out to me." You gave your email address, and I did that within, you know, an hour or so. And then 4 hours later, you wrote back to me and said, "Ellie, you're going to be in my book."
So, Ellie,
I'm lucky that you weren't on a short car ride when you heard it, or this never would have happened.
Ellie Krug, before I relinquish you, tell us a little bit about the legal work you have done since getting out of corporate litigation.
So, I was a trial lawyer defending corporations in high stakes personal injury and death cases. When I transitioned genders in 2009, I eventually lost my law firm because in 2009, transgender people were pretty verboten in the legal community. And I moved from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to Minneapolis to start all over. And in the time since then, I wrote a book, as you said, so thank you for that. And I founded a legal access nonprofit, and I ran that for 5 years. Unfortunately, that nonprofit did not survive the transition between me and another executive director. And now what I do is I go and speak across North America about human inclusivity, about how we can get along with each other regardless of our differences over skin color, LGBTQ status, or gender, or religion, or the other things that are separating us in the country. And I would not have been able to do that work without finally getting to be me as Ellie Krug, as somebody, as Gene knows, we've talked about, I'm a hopeless idealist, somebody who is desperately wants to make this world a better place.
Well, Ellie Krug, thank you for sharing your story. Gene, thank you for coming on the show today. We appreciate your time so much. Ellie Krug, an attorney, joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota, with her story of December 28th, 1986. Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you both. Bye.
And Gene Weingarten, we got about, I don't know, call it a minute and a half to wrap up this hour. But you tell stories about, you know, some of the first heart transplants in the U.S. You tell the story about a couple who got married on that date and then lived on the lam for years under an assumed name. After the husband nearly beat his wife to death, but she wanted to stay with him. She saw it as an aberration. Their son is now an NHL hockey star. You tell these incredible stories. What was the toughest one to track down, to pin down? What was the hardest one to figure out?
It was probably the one you just mentioned about the hockey star, Bobby Ryan. The story was not out there. I began with a single date when his parents got married, and it was part of a lawsuit. And it took forever to figure out who these people were, what happened to the lawsuit, how they became federal fugitives, and then ultimately it was the final bit of reporting that said, "Wait a minute, these are the parents of Bobby Ryan." So that one took the longest time and delivered perhaps the biggest surprise at the end.
It's a crazy O. Henry twist at that. Lastly, Gene Weingarten, what were you doing the 28th of December, 1986?
You know, I spent a lot of time trying to remember exactly what I was doing.
Oh, lamentable.
I don't know for sure, but I do know that on that day, I had a story in the Miami Herald. I worked at the Miami Herald at the time, and the story turned out to be completely central to what the last chapter in this book was about. That story wound up getting into the book as well.
Terrific. You're going to hear the song that was a hit in 1986 as we go out. It's called The Way It Is by Bruce Hornsby and The Range. We've been talking this hour with Gene Weingarten. He's author of the book One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. Thanks, Gene, for joining us.
Great to be here.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. This program, On Point, it's produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik. That's The Way It Is. This is On Point. But don't you believe that? Said, "Hey, little boy, you can't go where the others go. You don't look like they do." Said, "Hey, old man, how can you stand to think that way? Did you really think about it before you made the rules?" He said, "Sure, that's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is.